My heart gauged the direction of the wind. Criticism, condemnation, and complaint are creatures of the wind. They come and go on the wasted breath of lesser beings and have no power over me. The power to control direction belongs to me. Today, I will begin to exercise that power. My course has been charted. My destiny is assured. I have a decided heart. I am passionate about my vision for the future. I will awaken every morning with an excitement about the new day and its opportunity for growth and change. My thoughts and actions will work in forward motion, never sliding into the dark forest of doubt or the muddy quicksand of self-pity. I will freely give my vision for the future to others, and as they see the belief in my eyes, they will follow me. I will lay my head on my pillow at night, happily exhausted, knowing that I have done everything within my power to move the mountains in my path. As I sleep, the same dream that dominates my waking hours will be with me in the dark. Yes, I have a dream. It is a great dream, and I will never apologize for it. Neither will I ever let it go. For if I did, my life would be finished. My hopes, my passions, my vision for the future are my very existence. A person without a dream never had a dream come true. I have a decided heart. I will not wait. I know that the purpose of analysis is to come to a conclusion. I have tested the angles. I have measured the probabilities. And now I have made a decision with my heart. I am not timid. I will move now and not look back. What I put off until tomorrow, I will put off until the next day as well. I do not procrastinate. All my problems become smaller when I confront them. If I touch a thistle with caution, it will prick me. But if I grasp it boldly, its spines crumble into dust. I will not wait. I am passionate about my vision for the future. My course has been charted. My destiny is assured. I have a decided heart. Chapter 7. David felt the swaying of the Santa Maria as he looked up from the parchment. Columbus turned to stare as David stood up and saw that he was no longer in the crow's nest, but seemingly had his feet planted firmly in midair, moving at an ever-increasing pace away from the ship. Columbus smiled and raised his hand. David did the same and suddenly streaked away so fast that his vision perceived 1,000 images of Columbus as the Santa Maria stretched out like strobes of light in the tail of a comet. In the next instant, David was standing in a small room. The air smelled strongly of mildew with just a hint of lye soap. The only light in the room came from a bare bulb hanging on a wire from the ceiling. David quickly counted 7 people within several steps. He frowned. Incredibly, they were motionless. A man and woman were seated at a tiny table. 2 teenagers, a boy and a girl, were sprawled on the floor, an interrupted card game between them. And the rest, 2 men and a woman, appeared to have stopped in mid-stride. Every person wore a look of terror. David heard knocking on the wall behind him, and the muffled voices of men. As he turned to look, he noticed a small girl he had missed before. She was thin and sharply featured, with dark, wavy hair and eyes so black that they shined. She appeared to be perhaps 12 or 13, and wore a faded blue cotton dress that seemed at home in the dingy room. David understood why he had not seen her at first. She was standing right next to him, so close that he had literally looked over her. This girl, too, David saw, was not moving, but as he caught her gaze, she slowly raised a finger to her lips. The knocking seemed to run in a pattern, first high on the wall, then to the middle, and on toward the floor. The muffled voices would then move to the right, and the knocking would begin again, high, center, low. For almost 5 full minutes, David remained still as he listened to the sounds on the other side of the wall. Once, one of the voices began yelling something unintelligible, and they heard several people running. At that point, the woman sitting at the table reached out to hold the man's hand. Both closed their eyes, except for the small girl putting her fingers to her lips. It was the only movement David saw from any of them. After what seemed an eternity, the knocking ceased. There was no more running, no voices, just the tense silence of the little room, and still no one moved. For a full minute, then two. Finally, the man at the table took a deep breath and blew it out with a whoosh. "It is okay, Noel Amal," he said quietly. "It is all right now, everyone." And with that, the people in the room shook their heads and softly began talking to each other. "That was close, I am thinking," said the teenage boy on the floor. "If there had been dogs..." He let the thought just hang there, never finishing the sentence. A tall woman, her hair rolled tightly into a bun, began weeping softly. "Now then, Petronella," her husband said as he put his arms around her. "We are safe. Shh, hush now." He turned to the boy and said sternly, "Peter, that will be enough about what might have been. You have upset your mother and most everyone else, I expect. We'll have no more about dogs."
"I was just saying," Peter began.
"Yes," the man interrupted, "and I was just saying that will be enough." David watched as the man led his wife into a narrow room to his left. Before the door closed, he saw a mattress on the floor and a stack of movie star magazines. The young girl gently moved David to a corner and whispered,
"Stay here for now, but when I leave the room, follow me."
She moved toward the couple sitting at the table. The man looked tired, but even though his clothes were worn, he was clean-shaven except for a small mustache. What little hair he had left on his head was neatly combed. David thought him a rather distinguished sort. The woman sitting across from him, her hair in a bun just like the other woman had worn, was ghostly pale, as if she'd recently been ill. Nevertheless, she smiled as the girl approached.
"Papa," the girl said, "may I have your permission to go upstairs?"
The man smiled.
"Time to be alone again, is it?"
"Yes, Papa."
"Then certainly you may go," he said.
She gave a glance to David and moved resolutely to a stairway at the back of the room. Seeing her reach the stairs, her father spoke once more, his smile fading.
"Anne!"
She stopped and turned.
"Keep away from the window."
"Yes, Papa."
She nodded, and without a sound moved up the stairway and out of sight. David followed quickly, careful not to bump any of the people as he passed. Ascending the stairs, he saw the girl motioning for him to hurry. The staircase appeared to go directly into the ceiling, but as David soon saw, there was a hatch cover that provided an entrance to the attic. As soon as they were inside, the girl replaced the cover and said,
"I am so excited to meet you, I can almost not breathe."
She clapped her hands together quickly but softly. "This is thrilling, is it not?"
"Yes," David said, grinning at her enthusiasm. He glanced around. There was not a stick of furniture or a box of anything stored in this attic, just dust and dirt. I suppose thrilling would be a proper choice of words.
"I expected you. Did you know?" she said. "A dream is how. I even know your name. It is Mr. Ponder. I wrote you a note just this morning. Should I get it now?"
"No, no," David chuckled. "Slow down just a minute. You have me at a disadvantage. I don't even know where I am."
"Why, you are in Amsterdam," the child said.
She took David's hand and pulled him toward a window.
"Come," she said with a little smile. "I will show you the city."
Across the bare attic there loomed a large 9-paned window. Three of the panes had been separated from the other six by a brick column. The window itself was dirty, almost as brown as the attic.
"Is this the window," David asked, "that your father warned you to stay away from?"
"Yes," she said as she nodded her head, "but it is all right to peek from the corner."
And with that she got down on her hands and knees and exclaimed impatiently,
"You too. Come, now."
David got down on his hands and knees and followed the girl to the edge of the window, where she was waiting underneath the sill. When he reached her, he turned to sit on the floor, his back to the wall. She sat with her legs folded underneath her and leaned her right shoulder to the dirty plaster. As he settled himself into a more comfortable position, David said, "I heard your father call you Anne."
"Yes," she replied, "and my sister's name is Margot. She is very quiet. She was the one playing cards with the boy downstairs. His name is Peter, Peter Van Dan."
"What is your last name?" David asked.
"Frank," she said simply. "My papa's name is Otto, and Edith is my mother. Peter's parents are Mr. Herman and Mrs. Petronella. She was the one who cried, but of course she always cries. The other man you saw was Dr. Dussel. You did see him, didn't you? He was sitting on the floor near the door to my room, but of course you don't know which room is mine, so maybe you didn't see him. In any case, he's not a doctor, really. He's a dentist."
David wasn't certain how long Ann talked. He was not really listening anyway. His mind was a jumble of thoughts and emotion. "Ann Frank," he thought. "Ann Frank. This is the young girl whose diary I read in high school. So Peter brought him with us," Ann continued, ignoring the stunned look on the face of her guest. "Mushy is wonderful, though not as lovable as my own dear cat, Morgie, who is still at home. Mushy is black as coal dust. Morgie, on the other hand..." "I am in the annex," David thought. The annex, he knew, was a secret location consisting of several rooms connected to the back of a warehouse. Anne and her family were Dutch Jews in hiding during the Nazi occupation of Holland. "Don't you think?" Anne said as she looked directly at David, obviously waiting for a response. David was startled by the pause in her nonstop chatter. He had been so caught up in his surroundings that he hadn't actually been listening. "I'm sorry, what did you say?" he asked uncomfortably.
"I said," Anne answered slowly, "that Peter is very handsome, don't you think?"
"Peter?" David wrinkled his brow. "Oh, the boy downstairs, yes, yes, he is.
I let him kiss me sometimes, on the cheek, of course."
"Of course," David said seriously.
"Anne,"
David began in an effort to change the subject, "how long have you been here?"
"1 year and 4 months," she said.
"Do you know today's date?"
"Certainly. Today is Thursday, October 28th, 1943. We went into hiding last year on the first Sunday in July, the 5th it was."
Anne glanced up at the window above. "None of us have been outside in a very long time." "How do you get food in here?"
"Meep."
"Who is..."
"Meep is Papa's secretary. She still comes to work in the warehouse every day. After hours, she and her husband, Hank, move the bookcase in the accounting room and come through the door behind it."
"Anne," David said, "when I arrived..."
"Oh, yes," Anne broke in. "That was so terrifying. You appeared directly in front of me, and I was the only one who could see you. Have you done that before? Does it hurt?"
David smiled in spite of his aggravation at being interrupted. He supposed he could understand her excitement. After all, a new person with whom to talk must be thrilling after 16 months. "Yes, I have done it before, and no, it doesn't hurt." David reached out to touch her arm as he tried again to ask his question. "Anne, when I arrived, what or who was knocking on the walls?"
"Nazi soldiers," Anne said. "Papa calls them Gestapo. He says they dress in black. They have come now 2 times. We are quiet, and they go away."
She turned and got up on her knees, rising carefully to put one eye in the corner of the window.
"If you do this, you can see most of Amsterdam."
David rose and looked out the opposite corner. To his left, he saw a huge chestnut tree reaching almost 100 feet in the air and casting its last shade of the day into the attic window. A clock tower stood majestically across the street. Its spires and gables were the centerpiece of the city.
"That's the Westerkerk," Anne said, referring to the clock. "I can lie here and watch the hands move."
Anne laid herself out flat on the floor.
"Lie down," she said. "See for yourself."
David eased himself down beside the young girl and looked up. There, framed in the window as if by divine providence, was the clock face of the Westerkerk Tower. It was, he noticed, almost 6 o'clock in the evening. David looked at Anne, staring intently at the clock, and thought of his own daughter. She and Anne were about the same age. He tried to imagine Jenny in this situation. What would she do? How would she react? Or, for that matter, how would he?
"What are you thinking?" David asked softly.
"About the clock," Anne said. "Sometimes I wish for it to speed up.
and at other times I beg it to slow down. But it never hears me. It is always the same."
David jumped as whistles and loud, angry voices blasted the silence of the street four floors below them. Anne did not move, but continued gazing at the clock.
"What is going on?" David asked.
"It is a razzia," Anne answered with no emotion. "They are rounding up Jews. It makes me wonder about my friends. I don't know what has happened to any of them."
For several moments she was quiet, thoughtful. David said nothing. Then she looked directly at him and said,
"Everyone is being taken away to camps. Did you know? The Germans say the Jews are working and living comfortably, but it is not true."
David was careful with his words.
"How do you know that?"
Anne shrugged.
"We all know," she said. "Letters are censored, of course, but occasionally the truth is made known. Meep received a postcard from a friend that said the food was good and conditions were superb. But at the end of the message he wrote, 'Give my regards to Ellen de Groot.'"
She paused.
"The words were Dutch, of course. The German censors did not know that Ellen means misery. Groot is terrible. His intent was to convey a message of terrible misery."
Without warning, the Westerkerk clock tower began to chime. Six times the clapper hammered out its message of time on the lip of the massive bell. Less than 70 feet away, Anne merely placed her hands over her ears and smiled at David, who had nearly jumped out of his skin when the chiming began.
"It is only a bit too loud,"
Anne said, giggling at her understatement. David smiled.
"I'm glad you think it's funny," he said. "I thought my head was about to come off. How do you sleep with that thing ringing day and night?"
"Actually," Anne said, "we don't even notice it much anymore. Mrs. Petronella is the only one of us who even makes comment. Papa says the clock is a good thing for her because it provides something to complain about every hour on the hour."
David laughed. "What about you?" he asked. "What do you complain about?"
"I do not complain," Anne said. "Papa says complaining is an activity, just as jumping rope or listening to the radio is an activity. One may choose to turn on the radio, one may choose not to turn on the radio. One may choose to complain, and one may choose not to complain. I choose not to complain."
David stared at the sincere little girl for a moment, then said, "I don't mean any offense to what your father has taught you, but have you taken a look around here? These are pretty rough conditions for anyone, never mind a girl your age. How can you not complain?" Anne tilted her head to the side as if she were having difficulty understanding. Sweeping a lock of hair from her eyes, she said patiently,
"Our very lives are fashioned by choice, Mr. Ponder. First we make choices, then our choices make us. Rough conditions? Yes. An ungrateful person might see this place as too small for 8 people. A diet that is limited and portions that are too meager. Or only 3 dresses for 2 girls to share. But gratefulness is also a choice. I see an annex that hides 8 people while others are being herded onto railway cars. I see food that is generously provided by Meep, whose family uses their ration cards for us. I see an extra dress for my sister and me, while there are others, surely, who have nothing. I choose to be grateful. I choose not to complain."
David was amazed at the self-control that Anne seemed to possess. He tucked one leg under the other, sitting cross-legged, and shook his head as if to clear the cobwebs. "Are you honestly telling me that you are always in a good mood?" Anne had folded her legs to mimic the way David was sitting. As she draped her dress over her knees, she laughed.
"Of course not, silly. But if I ever find myself in a bad mood, I immediately make a choice to be happy. In fact, it is the first choice I make every day. I say out loud to my mirror, 'Today, I will choose to be happy.' I smile into the mirror and laugh, even if I am sad. I just laugh right out loud. And soon, I am happy, exactly as I have chosen to be."
David was now shaking his head in wonder. "You're a very special young lady, Miss Frank."
"Thank you," Anne said.
That is also a choice.
David leaned forward. Really? He said with his eyebrows raised. You've got me now. Explain.
My life, my personality, my habits, even my speech, is a combination of the books I choose to read, the people I choose to listen to, and the thoughts I choose to tolerate in my mind. Before the war, when I was a little girl, my papa took me to Het Vondelpark on Sunday afternoon to hear the orchestra play. At the end of the concert, from behind the musicians, 100 helium balloons of red and blue and yellow and green floated up into the sky. It was so exciting. I tugged on Papa's arm and asked, Papa, which color balloon will go the highest? And he said to me, Anne, it is not the color of the balloon that is important. It's what's inside that makes all the difference. For a moment, Anne was quiet, and the attic still. She seemed so deep in thought that David barely breathed. Then she looked David directly in the eye, lifted her chin, and said, Mr. Ponder, I don't believe that being Jewish or Aryan or African has any bearing on what one can become. Greatness does not care if one is a boy or a girl. If, in fact, it is what's inside us that makes all the difference, then the difference is made when we choose what goes inside. Anne turned and looked toward the clock again. David had not noticed the darkness that had filled the attic, but now realized that only the glow of the light from the Westerkirk Tower enabled him to see Anne's face. I must get ready for dinner soon, she said. Come with me to my room. I have written something for you. David followed Anne through the hatch in the attic, down the stairs and back into the living area. Dinner is almost on the table, dear, her mother said as the two walked by. 5 minutes, no longer. Anne led David to a door that was situated to the right of the staircase. As they walked inside and closed the door behind them, David could see that the room was no larger than a closet. A small mattress lay on the floor with 2 stacks of books beside the only pillow. Margot and I share this room, Anne said. It is very close, but we respect each other's privacy.
David didn't see how anyone could hope to have any privacy in this tiny room. On the wall at the foot of the bed hung a simple white dress. The hem, sleeves and neckline were stitched in small red flowers. Above the head of the bed were pictures cut from magazines and newspapers that had been glued to the wall. Pointing to the array, David asked, Are these yours, or do they belong to your sister?
They are mine, Anne smiled. Beautiful, aren't they?
David looked more closely. There was a picture of Greta Garbo and one of Ginger Rogers. A picture of the head of the Statue of David by Michelangelo was positioned over a picture of a house in the country. To the left was a black and white photo of a rose that someone had colored pink, and a large picture of chimpanzees having a tea party. Spread all over the wall were pictures of cute, cuddly babies. Yes, they are beautiful, David said. What do they represent?
My future, Anne whispered softly as she reached out to touch the picture of the rose. These are the people I want to meet, the places I want to see, and the things I want in my life. Laughter and love, and a home with a husband, maybe Peter, and lots of babies.
Suddenly tears came to her eyes. David reached out, his hand cupping her head and drawing her to him. Anne put her arms around David's neck as he sank to his knees. As Anne sniffled and sobbed, tears also ran down David's cheeks. He felt such deep admiration for this child. Her courage and wisdom were those of a person who had already lived a lifetime, and in a way, he knew, she had.
I'm sorry, she said. I didn't mean to make you uncomfortable.
I wasn't uncomfortable, Anne, David said as he dried his own eyes. You remind me of my daughter. Her name is Jennifer. We call her Jenny. She is about your age, and I think that you and she are the 2 prettiest girls I've ever seen. Anne blushed.
Thank you for saying so.
She looked back at the wall and reached out to touch the rose picture again.
"May I ask you a question?" she said.
"Certainly," David replied.
"If your Jenny were here instead of me, would she be afraid?"
David could feel the pulse pounding in his head. "I think she probably would be afraid, Anne. Are you?" Anne pulled her hand down from the rose and clasped both hands in front of her. Momentarily, she cut her eyes toward David, then back to the pictures.
"Sometimes," she said. "But most often I choose not to be. Papa says fear is a poor chisel with which to carve out tomorrow."
Anne turned and faced David.
"I will have it tomorrow, Mr. Ponder. Margot and Mrs. Petronella, they make fun of me. They call me a Pollyanna. They say that I live in a dream world, that I do not face reality. That is not true. I know that the war is horrible. I understand we are in terrible danger here. I do not deny the reality of our situation. I deny the finality of it. This, too, shall pass."
Anne knelt down and reached under the mattress. She pulled out a red-orange, checkered, cloth-bound book.
"This is my diary," she said. "Papa gave it to me for my birthday, June 12th.
She thumbed through the pages quickly until she found what she was looking for.
"These are yours," she said, and carefully tore several pages from the small journal.
David took the pages from her hand and watched as she placed what he knew to be her life's work back under the dirty mattress.
"Thank you, Anne."
She stood awkwardly in front of him for a long moment.
"Will you tell your daughter, Jenny, that I said hello?"
David smiled. "Yes, I will." Anne paused again.
"I must go eat," she said. "You will be gone when I return?"
"Yes."
"Then remember me," Anne said, smiling. "I will remember you. But most of all, both of us must remember that life itself is a privilege, but to live life to its fullest, well, that is a choice."
With those words, Anne hugged David and quickly left the room, softly closing the door behind her. David sat down on the mattress and looked up at the pictures on the wall. For several minutes, he listened to the quiet murmuring of the Franks and their friends eating dinner. Then he put the pages Anne had given him in his lap. These were the words he fully expected to change his life. 4 small pages, written with a pencil, in the handwriting of a little girl. The 5th decision for success. Today I will choose to be happy. Beginning this very moment, I am a happy person. For now I truly understand the concept of happiness. Few others before me have been able to grasp the truth of the physical law that enables one to live happily every day. I know now that happiness is not an emotional phantom floating in and out of my life. Happiness is a choice. Happiness is the end result of certain thoughts and activities which actually bring about a chemical reaction in my body. This reaction results in a euphoria that, while elusive to some, is totally under my control. Today, I will choose to be happy. I will greet each day with laughter. Within moments of awakening, I will laugh for 7 seconds. Even after such a small period of time, excitement has begun to flow through my bloodstream. I feel different. I am different. I am enthusiastic about the day. I'm alert to its possibilities. I am happy. Laughter is an outward expression of enthusiasm, and I know that enthusiasm is the fuel that moves the world. I laugh throughout the day. I laugh while I'm alone. I laugh in conversations with others. People are drawn to me because I have laughter in my heart. The world belongs to the enthusiastic, for people will follow them anywhere. Today, I will choose to be happy. I will smile at every person I meet. My smile has become my calling card. It is, after all, the most potent weapon I possess. My smile has the strength to forge bonds, break ice, and calm storms. I will use my smile constantly. Because of my smile, the people with whom I come in contact on a daily basis will choose to further my causes and follow my leadership. I will always smile first.
That particular display of a good attitude will tell others what I expect in return. My smile is the key to my emotional makeup. A wise man once said, I do not sing because I'm happy. I'm happy because I sing. When I choose to smile, I become the master of my emotions. Discouragement, despair, frustration, and fear will always wither when confronted by my smile. The power of who I am is displayed when I smile. Today, I will choose to be happy. I am the possessor of a grateful spirit. In the past, I have found discouragement in particular situations until I compared the condition of my life to others less fortunate. Just as a fresh breeze cleans smoke from the air, so a grateful spirit removes the cloud of despair. It is impossible for the seeds of depression to take root in a thankful heart. My God has bestowed upon me many gifts, and for these I will always remember to be grateful. Too many times I have offered up the prayers of a beggar, always asking for more and forgetting to give thanks. I do not wish to be seen as a greedy child, unappreciative and disrespectful. I am grateful for sight and sound and breath. If ever in my life there is a pouring out of blessings beyond that, then I will be grateful for the miracle of abundance. I will greet each day with laughter. I will smile at every person I meet. I am the possessor of a grateful spirit. Today, I will choose to be happy. Chapter 8. David finished reading the words Anne had prepared and wiped at a tear clinging to his chin. Blinking his eyes, he folded the pages, placed them in the tobacco pouch, shoved the pouch into his pocket, and stood up. He reached out to touch the picture of the rose Anne had glued to the wall. With his finger, David traced the stem from the bottom of the photograph to its center. Touching the bloom, he smiled at the waxy feeling of the pink crayon that had been used to color the black-and-white picture. Slowly, the rose began to distort. The edges appeared fuzzy, and the shape of the bloom pulsed. David pulled his hand back and wiped his eyes. With his left elbow and forearm, he steadied himself against the wall. There, for a moment, he was mildly dizzy, but the feeling quickly passed. Opening his eyes, David examined the picture again. It was still blurry, but seemed to be clearing. He squinted and moved his face only inches from the flower. There. Now it was in focus. He saw the petals of the rose so sharply, so distinctly, that it seemed to have depth. Tentatively, without moving his face, David reached out with his right hand and, using just one finger, touched the rose. Startled, David's breath caught in his throat. The rose was real. For a moment he froze. Shifting his eyes, David saw that his left arm was now braced against an old desk. Easing himself away from the rose, he noticed that it stood in a simple crystal vase on the edge of the desk. Next to the rose sat a pitcher of water and four glasses. David stood erect and looked around. He was in a room of some sort. No, a tent. It was a rather large tent, he noted, made of white canvas, enclosing an area of approximately 15 by 20 feet. The floor was dead grass, and except for the desk and three plain wooden chairs, the tent was empty. Hearing activity of some sort, David moved to the closed flap of the tent's entrance. Carefully, he eased the loose canvas door aside several inches. About 75 feet away, on a raised platform or makeshift stage, a man stood alone behind a podium. He was facing away from the tent, speaking to thousands of people. David saw saddled horses and carriages and wagons interspersed among the throng. Many had parasols to ward off the sun, and they had spread quilts on the ground or sat atop their wagons. David saw that the tent and the stage were on top of a hill surrounded by large trees. Since most of their leaves had dropped and the temperature was comfortable, even in the tent, David supposed he had arrived in this place during October or maybe even November. In any case, it was autumn, he decided, and judging by the sun, it was somewhere close to noon. Beyond the crowd, David saw fields and broken forest land that stretched as far as he could see from his limited vantage point. The hills and pastures within his view gave David a strange feeling. The area seemed eerily familiar, though he couldn't quite place how or why. Perhaps, David thought, the speaker holds the key to why I'm here. Turning his attention once again toward the stage, David observed that the gentleman, from behind, appeared to be elegantly dressed. He wore gray pants over polished black boots, and a high white collar rose from the back of a black coat, complete with tails. His flowing gray hair completed the look of distinction. In addition, the man appeared to be quite the orator. David noticed how he paced the stage and gestured dramatically with his hands. His audience certainly seemed enthralled. They had laughed as a group twice during the short time David watched from the doorway of the tent. David couldn't quite hear the speaker's presentation, for there was no microphone or sound system of any kind, and because the man faced away from him, David could only catch a word here or there. Suddenly, the crowd thundered a loud and sustained applause. David looked closely as the speaker returned to the podium, which was on the speaker's right and slightly behind him at that moment. As the man waited for the ovation to die away, David got a clear view of his features. His hairline receded from a clean-shaven face. The man's eyebrows were bushy. His nose and ears were a bit large for his head. David didn't recognize him at all. Disappointed and somewhat confused, David eased himself back inside the tent. For several moments he stood there, wondering where he was and who he had been watching on stage. "Is that the person I'm here to see?" he asked himself. David moved to a chair beside the desk and sat down heavily. Pouring himself a glass of water, he couldn't shake the uneasy feeling that he was somehow connected to this place. Just then, above the continuous sound of the speaker, David heard the crowd begin to murmur. For almost half a minute, the audiences, talking among themselves, easily drowned out the voice of the man on stage. David rose from his chair and quickly walked toward the tent door. Before he reached the entrance, however, he heard the sound of horses' hooves and creaking leather saddles just outside. Hearing voices approach, David stepped to the corner of the tent as one man walked inside. He was a young man of about 25, impeccably groomed in a long coat and high collar. His hair was parted crisply in the middle, and his thin mustache ran in a perfect line above his lips. With the presence of a person who is accustomed to being in charge, the young man strode across the tent directly to the desk. He opened each drawer and carefully inspected the contents before closing it. David saw him pause for the briefest moment when he spied David's glass of water. The young man picked up the glass and frowned. He was obviously quite aggravated. Shaking his head from side to side with little jerks, he took the glass to the far corner of the tent and poured the remainder of the water onto the ground. Curiously, David thought, he then placed the empty glass in his coat pocket and moved back to the desk where he proceeded to examine the remaining glasses and pitcher. He picked up the pitcher and looked intently into the water. Then he smelled the water. Finally, he poured a small amount into one of the three glasses left on the desk and carefully tasted it. Satisfied, he then placed that glass into his other coat pocket, looked cautiously around the tent, and exited. David took a deep breath. Evidently, that person was not the one he was there to see. The man hadn't even noticed him standing in plain sight. Before David had time to move, the tent flap opened again. Bending almost double in order to fit through the door, this man entered with his hat under his arm. As the tent flap closed behind him, the tall man straightened, glanced around, and saw David. He smiled, and with two quick strides stood before David, extending his right hand. "Mr. Ponder, isn't it?" the man said with a twinkle in his eye. David's mouth was open, and his knees felt as if they might collapse. He wanted to say, "Yes, sir," or "How do you do?" or "Nice to meet you," or anything, but his throat was so dry that nothing came out. Becoming aware of the bemused expression on the gentleman's face, and seeing that his hand was still extended, David did the only appropriate thing. He shook the hand of Abraham Lincoln. I'm honored, sir, David managed to stammer.
The honor is mine, Mr. Ponder, the president replied. After all, it is you who has traveled the greater distance for this occasion.
Lincoln wore white riding gloves, gauntlets that contrasted sharply with his totally black attire and made his large hands seem larger still. Removing the gloves, he walked to the desk, and after placing the gloves and his hat on the far side, asked, "Won't you join me, please, in refreshment?" Seeing that the president had indicated the pitcher of water, David accepted his offer and asked, Sir, where are we? Lincoln held up one long finger, then poured David a glass of water. Pouring his own glass, he drank it all, poured another, and sat down.
Bring up a chair,
he said, as he drew his own from behind the desk. As David sat down, he watched the 16th President of the United States cross his legs at the knee and loosen his high-starched collar. He was dressed well. His hair was combed, his beard neatly trimmed, and yet he still appeared somewhat, well, disheveled. David noticed that the President seemed oversized in all physical respects. His legs, arms, hands, even his face appeared to be too long. David smiled to himself as he realized that Abraham Lincoln looked exactly like every picture he'd ever seen of the man. David's only surprise after Lincoln's sudden appearance was the President's voice. It was not a rich baritone as he had heard it portrayed in numerous movies, but a higher-pitched tenor. Lincoln placed the glass on the desk and said, "Riding horseback always makes me thirsty, though I'm usually too embarrassed to drink in front of the horse. After all," he chuckled, "I'm not the one who's done the work." David laughed politely. "So, Mr. Ponder, you wish to know where we are?"
"Yes, sir, and please call me David."
"Thank you," Lincoln said as he slightly inclined his head to the younger man. "David, I am here for two reasons today. First, to dedicate a cemetery. That, by the way, is where we are now, Gettysburg, Pennsylvania."
Shivers ran down David's back.
"And the date?" "November 19th, 1863.
No wonder this place seems so familiar, David thought. I was here 4 months ago. Or was it only an hour? He shook his head to clear his thoughts. "Mr. President, you mentioned two reasons you came here. What was the second?"
Lincoln smiled. "Why, to meet you, of course." David's eyes widened. "You are certainly more important than any remarks I might share with those in attendance today. This cemetery is about the past. You are about the future."
David looked away. "I appreciate your confidence," he said. "But I'm not sure it's justified at the moment. I'm just hoping there is a future. I'm actually going through the worst time in my life right now."
"Well, congratulations are in order, then. Better days are most assuredly ahead."
The President then raised his water glass and exclaimed,
"To us, two men experiencing the worst life has to offer."
David didn't respond. He wasn't sure whether Lincoln was teasing him or not. "I'm not kidding," he said slowly.
"Oh, let me promise you," Lincoln said with a tight smile. "Neither am I."
He reached to his right across the desk and picked up his hat. It was the tall black stovepipe that had become as much a part of the man as any image David could remember. For a time, Lincoln let his fingers play softly across the large silk band.
"This is a piece of cloth I carry with me in memory of Willie, my little boy. He died only a few months ago."
He took a deep breath and sighed.
"Now my son Tad has taken to bed, deathly ill. And, as you might imagine, Mrs. Lincoln did not agree that I should be here today."
"Why did you come?"
"Duty. And the fact that I knew I could choose to pray for my son while wandering about the White House, or pray as I continued in pursuit of the task that has been placed before me. I am quite confident the Almighty hears my cry, no matter the location. Surely his arms stretch from Washington to Gettysburg. I also believe the good Lord would rather me pray and work, not pray and wait."
The President shifted position in the chair and crossed his arms.
"You know, I mentioned a moment ago that we were two men who were experiencing the worst life has to offer. That is true in a smaller, selfish way, and I must confess my propensity toward self-serving behavior. Actually, it seems to be one of my life's most constant battles. In a larger sense, however, we are being presented an enormous opportunity for change and the betterment of ourselves."
"The betterment of ourselves? You're talking about what we call personal growth. And I'm not sure I want any more personal growth," David said.
"Of course not," Lincoln responded. "And wouldn't that be the easy choice to make? In fact, it's the most popular choice on the planet. But the question you are facing at this particular point in your life is, how powerful do you want to be?"
David tilted his head to the side. Confused, he said, "I'm lost here. In the first place, what does personal growth have to do with power? And in the second place, no offense, but I have no interest in power anyway." Leaning forward, Lincoln said, "Mr. Ponder, David, if that is true, if you have no interest in power, then an incalculable amount of attention is being wasted on you, some of it at this very moment." David wasn't certain whether to be insulted or not. He began to speak. "I was not the one who..." Lincoln reached over and touched David's knee. Smiling patiently but interrupting firmly, he said, "David." As David became silent, the president leaned back in his chair. With his dark eyes still on David and the smile still on his face, he said softly, "Now think with me here. Personal growth leads to power. There is a certain level of personal growth that will provide the skills necessary to feed and clothe one's family. There is another level of personal growth that will furnish influence and wisdom in sufficient quantities to be perceived a leader." Lincoln paused. He looked directly into the younger man's eyes. "But to do great deeds, great power is essential. Do not run from power. Gather it as you would the finest fruit. Power in the hands of a good person is like a cool drink of water on a hot summer day. It refreshes everyone with whom it comes in contact. You see, some people want just enough power to get by. Then there are other people who will acquire enough power to make things more comfortable for their families, and they'll include other less fortunate souls in their charity if the personal growth part of the equation doesn't become too uncomfortable. But there are a few of us, David, who have latched on to this silly idea that we can change the world. We will develop the power to ignore what is popular and do what is right. One person can attain the power to lead hundreds of thousands of people to the promised land of their dreams. As children, we were afraid of the dark. Now, as adults, we are afraid of the light. We are afraid to step out. We are afraid to become more. But how can we lead others to a destination we have not reached? Keep searching, son. I am urging you to seek the light that to you seems so far in the distance. It will be worth the journey. You will become a lighthouse of personal growth and power. And by your example and leadership, you will prevent many a worthy man from crashing his life upon the rocks of mediocrity." "Now I see what you're saying," David said, nodding. "So how do I engineer my personal growth? What is it that's important in this quest?"
"Well," Lincoln began, "it has always been enlightening for me to question myself."
"About what?"
"About myself."
"You question yourself about yourself?"
"Yes," the president said with a laugh. "At least I generally know all the answers."
Stroking his beard with the back of his hand, he continued,
"Seriously, questions such as, how do other people see me? And what don't they like? Can be quite revealing if answered honestly. When you become a person whom others want to be around, you will have become a person of influence."
"Then I'm to work at pleasing people?" David asked.
"Not necessarily. I am speaking primarily of honing the rough edges you might find in your physical appearance and actions such as manners and speech. Of course, I continue to find fertile ground for change in my attitude. But you will never please everyone, nor should pleasing everyone be your goal. For example, to seek the approval of someone who is lazy or jealous is to cast your pearls before swine. You will find that God rarely uses a person whose main concern is what others are thinking."
"Are you ever bothered by what other people say about you?" David asked. The president quickly leaned forward with a serious look on his face.
"Why," he said, "what are they saying?"
Seeing David's shocked expression, Lincoln laughed loudly.
"David, I inherited a nightmare from President Buchanan. By the time I was sworn in, 7 states had already seceded from the Union, and Jefferson Davis was named President of the Confederate States of America. Just between us, Buchanan was no great help. He left Washington proclaiming himself the last president of the United States. As you may know, I am the first ever Republican president. I was elected by a minority of the popular vote, and even some of the members of my own cabinet view me as third rate. To many of the elite in Washington, I will always be a country lawyer, a gawky, unrefined outsider. If I were to concern myself with the newspaper columns that labeled me dishonest or stupid, if I had my feelings destroyed every time a political opponent called me an ape or a buffoon, I would never be about the work for which I was born.
Lincoln stood and shoved his hands into his pockets.
Sooner or later, every man of character will have that character questioned. Every man of honor and courage will be faced with unjust criticism. But never forget that unjust criticism has no impact whatsoever upon the truth. And the only sure way to avoid criticism is to do nothing and be nothing.
As he paused for a breath, Lincoln's attention was diverted by loud, rolling applause from the gathering outside the tent. He grinned and motioned for David to come with him.
"Let's see where we are in the program."
Moving to the tent's entrance, the president eased the door flap aside, affording them a clear view of the stage. The same gentleman David had seen earlier was still speaking. "Who is he?" David asked quietly. Without turning, Lincoln answered,
"That is our principal orator at this occasion, the Honorable Edward Everett. He was the president of Harvard University and Secretary of State under President Fillmore. He can certainly hold an audience in the palm of his hand. Look at the faces of the people. They are transfixed."
"I'm sure they're waiting for you, sir," David replied. Lincoln smiled and carefully dropped the flap. Backing away from the entrance, he said,
"I appreciate the compliment, but today I have only a few remarks. I am here for the dedication. I was invited only 3 weeks ago."
At that instant, the door flap was thrown aside, and the young, smartly dressed man who had been in the tent earlier entered. Lincoln gestured toward him with his hand and said,
"John Hay, my personal secretary."
David froze momentarily, and then held his laughter as the young man hesitated. He watched as Hay looked from side to side, then glanced around the tent and said hesitantly,
"Sir?"
Recovering quickly, Lincoln asked,
"How may I be of assistance, John?"
Hay wrinkled his brow, obviously puzzled, and continued to peer cautiously behind the president.
"John," Lincoln said again, snapping Hay to attention, "how may I be of assistance?"
Excuse the interruption, Mr. President."
Now Lincoln stifled a chuckle. David had his hand over his mouth.
Well, sir, Hay stammered, "I wanted you to know that when Mr. Everett has concluded, the Baltimore Glee Club will sing an ode written for this occasion. The music will provide the time necessary to escort you from here to the stage."
"Thank you, John," Lincoln said as he moved to the doorway. "The beginning of the music, then, will be my cue to join you outside the tent. Until that time, sir, I trust you will maintain my privacy."
The president pulled back the door flap, an obvious gesture intended to hasten his secretary's departure. Hay ducked through the opening and turned around. Bent over, half inside and half outside the tent, Hay carefully worded his question.
"Sir, excuse me, but are you saying that I should not come back inside?"
"That is correct, John."
"So you will meet me outside the tent when you are ready to go to the stage?"
"Yes, John."
Briefly, Hay paused. Then, still doubled over in the doorway, he said,
"Sir, if I may be so bold as to ask..."
"John?"
Lincoln interrupted.
"Yes, sir?" "I will meet you outside the tent when I'm ready to go to the stage."
"Yes, sir," Hay said resignedly, and slid outside the door. The president closed the canvas and, urging David to follow with a jerk of his head, walked quickly to his desk. As he sat down, tears were streaming down his face as he finally let his laughter burst forth. For several moments, they both laughed heartily. Gaining control, Lincoln took a deep breath and sighed.
"That was extremely close, my friend. Momentarily, I forgot he could not see you. John is a fine young man, and I hate to laugh at his expense,
but if the Almighty will forgive me, the look on his face was priceless. David chuckled as he sat down, tipping the chair back on two legs into a more comfortable position.
Before your secretary entered, sir, you were talking about your part in the ceremony today.
Yes.
Lincoln's smile disappeared as he cleared his throat.
Yes. Today we take pause from our battles to dedicate one ugly reality of this war, a cemetery. There are quite a few of them around now, as you must know. Certainly more than I can dedicate.
Lincoln frowned and continued.
There were more than 50,000 casualties here. They say blood and gore ran in rivulets on the ground.
He was quiet for a moment, and then brightening, he said,
Well, I have Grant now. This will not last much longer.
Are you winning the war? David asked.
We weren't, I can tell you that. But after this battle, Gettysburg, last July, the outcome seems much brighter indeed.
David suddenly had a thought and asked, Mr. President, are you familiar with an officer in your army by the name of Colonel Joshua Chamberlain? He is with the 20th Maine. Lincoln cocked his head and thought briefly, then said slowly,
No, I don't believe so. Should I know this man?
Maybe. He fought here at Gettysburg. When you return to Washington, you might look him up. The president nodded.
I have another question, David continued. Do you believe that God is on your side?
Lincoln looked at David thoughtfully.
On September 22nd of last year, I signed a proclamation of emancipation for all slaves, specifying that they would be henceforward and forever free. Now, the timing of that gesture is still the subject of some debate. One of my cabinet members made it known to anyone who would listen that a vast majority of the public stood against me and my intention to sign the Emancipation Proclamation. My platform, however, is that while public opinion might sway back and forth, right and wrong do not. If we familiarize ourselves with the chains of bondage, we prepare our own limbs to wear them. The spirit of our government and our institutions must be to elevate people, and I am opposed to whatever degrades them. I am of the opinion that right makes might. Therefore, I signed the document, and now we will enforce its effectiveness. So your question was, do I believe that God is on our side? To be quite honest, I haven't given that question very much attention. I am much more concerned with whether we are on God's side.
David remembered something Lincoln had said earlier. You mentioned Grant, he prompted. Why will he make such a difference?
Because he cares as I do, came the sharp reply. It has taken me almost 3 years to find a general officer whom I don't have to watch over like a nursemaid. Winfield Scott was my first general-in-chief, then McDowell, followed by Fremont, then the disastrous McClellan. Can you imagine? In McClellan, I had a commander of the entire Union Army who refused to engage the enemy. After McClellan, I appointed Henry Halleck. Halleck is a graduate of West Point and has even written a book on military tactics. I read it last year before his appointment. Fine book. Good theory. But books don't fight wars. The man evaded all personal responsibility, lost what little composure he brought to the task, and became nothing more than a first-rate clerk. McClernand was next, and all he did was complain about the other generals. It was the odd week I didn't receive a long, rambling communication critical of something Sherman or Grant had done. After McClernand, I suffered through Rosecrans, then Burnside, and finally Nathaniel P. Banks. Naturally, the day I announced my intentions to promote General Grant, I was vilified in the press. Actually, many people have been pushing for Grant's dismissal, but I can't spare this man. He fights. I've heard it said that he drinks too much. Well, if I can find out exactly what he's drinking, I'll send a few cases to the other generals.
David laughed at that comment. Lincoln smiled and continued.
I suppose the point of all this is that Ulysses S. Grant wants to win as badly as I do. If you are determined to win, you will have to surround yourself with winners. Don't be discouraged by the people you might choose for your team who talk big but produce little. Grant is my 10th try. I just keep putting them in the boat to see who wants to paddle as hard as I do.
What will you do if, when you win?"